Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is brought to you today by PetMate Plastic Dog Crates, trusted providers of safety and comfort for your dog. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and I am so excited about this next guest. We spoke with Dr. Victor Stora very briefly during the Love the Breeds roundtable for the Shetland Sheepdogs at their national, and he happened to drop that he was this veterinary medical geneticist. And I'm like, oh honey, you and I are... You and I are going to talk. And he was gracious enough to share some of his time. Dr. Stora is working at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine in the research sector, correct?
That's correct.
Currently? Okay. So share with us. Give us a little 411. We know you're a Sheltie guy. So how you got started in dogs and veterinary medicine. And I would love for you to share, because you are a very special person in the dog community, but you were a recipient of the AKC Canine Health Foundation Therianology residency, correct?
That's correct.
So cool. So hit it.
My name is Dr. Victor Stora. I grew up and currently in New York City. I live in Staten Island. There I breed Shelties. I kind of got into breeding dogs and genetics from Shelties. So my first one, my uncle had, and then my dad kept going over to his house and he was taking it out and he was giving it food and water. And then one day my uncle was like, just take the dog, take the bowl, take everything. It's yours now. I don't have time for him. And then we got our first Sheltie, and then it kind of exploded from there.
Like potato chips, right? You can't just have one.
No, basically, yeah. We had one. And then when I went into undergrad, I got two more. My mom was like, why are there two instead of just one? Why can't we just get one? So I started getting more and more dogs after that, but never really breeding until after my residency. But first I did undergrad in New York at Wagner College, and I got a Bachelor of Science in Molecular Biology and Biochemistry. And I didn't know that you could join that really nice science side with the veterinary medicine side, because I didn't want to give up being a vet.
Right.
And then that kind of tumbled into this residency where it's reproduction based. So theriogenology is the study of animal reproduction. And my residency was based in small animal medicine. So for dogs and cats.
Right.
Yeah, because who wants to do horses if you like dogs and cats? It's just something that basically is the barrier for so many people trying to do that part.
Right.
And so after that, I kind of started that residency and the genetic side started pulling in harder.
Nice. So AKC Canine Health Foundation really helped you kind of come to the dark side, if you will. So we're excited about that.
Yeah.
Totally.
They were the ones that let me get the food in the door, so.
I love that. See, this was perfect. This was just, I wanted to give them a huge shout out. Diane Brown's doing some great work over there. So talk to us a little bit. Veterinary medical geneticist. One of the big things that everybody, it's a hot topic these days, right? It's a hot button topic, is breeding our dogs and creating type and consistency of style while having a coefficiency index that's maybe a little lower, a little more open pedigree, right? So give us some ideas. Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about this concept and some ideas and some workable methods that people can use to do this.
So this is an area that actually I give presentations and seminars on, and it is a big question. And one of my biggest kind of maybe complaints about looking at this too hard is that someone typically will fall in one of these categories where they're looking at health too much and they're losing their type, or they're losing what actually makes that the breed. And then there are people who are ignoring health because they feel that they are just minor problems, or they are getting type that's what they want. They're getting what they envision in these breedings. And then there's not many that fall in that happy medium. And that's where most people should start or try to think that they should be falling. The biggest part is that you can health test your dog all you want, but that just means that for the what you've tested for, they are negative, or they are a carrier, or they, you know, they have those bad genes, but it doesn't mean that they're free of disease. So a lot of people will take these health testing and then they'll say that my dog is negative for everything, but that's just everything you can test for, right? That animal likely has disease behind there. So there's risk all the time, and you'll never get rid of all of the risk. So you have to look at it like, what are really bad diseases that affect this breed and what are we recommending we test for? For me, the most lethal diseases are my priority, ones that cause a significant problem to the animal.
Right.
Diseases that are maybe not ultimately going to harm the animal fully, but maybe what I term an annoyance, those go less. And it's not like I'm not prioritizing them, but you have to in some way because there's just so many. And new things will happen all the time. So when you're prioritizing and you get your list of what you're testing for, once the animals you screen come out or in your litter, then you're going to choose the ones that have the least problems health testing wise and are the most like the type or the line you desire. But health testing is a tool. It's not a meter to eliminate animals because they don't pass the bar. So if we talk about like the common Mendelian diseases dogs get or simple genetic diseases, so, you know, one carrier plus one carrier makes potentially disease.
Mm-hmm.
Those, if you test for them and you eliminate all the carriers, assuming the carrier state has no disease, you're eliminating a large population of dogs that are otherwise healthy, and you're using health testing to eliminate because it's easier to think about eliminating them than it is to use that in your breeding program as I have to find now a male that is or a female that is not, you know, a carrier of this, but it's still a good animal to breed. And I think a lot of people start zooming in too much on health testing, and then they're not looking at what they're creating or what they're trying to get in these litters, and they lose what they had in the beginning because they're honing in on health testing, but they're still seeing disease because, again, what we can test for,
right,
they are negative, but it is not for everything because there can be lots of other things that are happening that we don't have tests for yet.
Epilepsy, cancer, all of those things.
Yeah. The main ones that people want to know the answer for, we don't have an answer because they are likely environmental plus the lot you're dealt with.
Okay, so I liked what you were saying, the Mendelian, right? The 1 + 1 = we know. What about something, and I use this all the time as an example, frankly, because it's something that affects my breed and my breeding program. So I'm always curious, and it's a great example because it fills in for a lot of other diseases. Autoimmune thyroiditis, where you don't have a 1 + 1, where it's just sort of floats. Talk to us a little bit about that. How do you deal with something like that that's amorphous, where you can test clear carrier affected, or sort of at least clear and affected, and yet we don't have a good understanding of how it's genetically transmitted?
So I think that question is maybe how do we counsel genetic disorders when there is no known test, really, or a test is not predictive of disease complete yet.
Right.
And there are tests that are like that. You know, when we look at genetic testing, we can test for what we actually find the mutation. We can test for off-site targets that are near the mutation that gives a hint that the animal has a higher likelihood of having the disease-causative allele, which is a variant of a gene.
Mm-hmm.
Or we have phenotypic tests, and that's basically where a lot of the disorders will fall, which are just observation of the animal or screening tests like hip x-rays for hip dysplasia and looking at them subjectively and giving them some radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So most diseases that we don't have a real solid understanding of, we fall in phenotypic diagnostics, which unfortunately usually has the most critical penalty. So it's either clear they have disease or not, and they are eliminated based on minimal knowledge because we don't know what's causing it, and we don't know. We just know on the test we got this kind of marker. So because it's so much unknown, it is better to eliminate. And I do agree with that in some way. If it is a disease that you're really worried about and there is not really like a simply inherited pattern.
Right.
It's likely something we call polygenic traits, which are multiple genes involved. Polygenic traits follow something called continuous variation. So the disease or what you're looking at can vary in a spectrum. So with hip dysplasia, you know, we have mild, moderate, severe, or, you know, good, bad, excellent, and you have subcategories. What causes all those subcategories and severity, and why does that happen? And we have the environment, and then we have how many genes that you inherit or the animal inherits that are causing hip dysplasia. So it's kind of like you get one, another one, another one, another one. The likelihood goes up higher and higher. So with autoimmune disorders, we typically look at something called the MHC class or the DLA, which is the dog leukocyte antigen gene. And we look at the MHC class, which is the major histocompatibility class. They're the same. One's a human term, one's a dog term.
Mm-hmm.
Those are just talking about what kind of white blood cell, you know, groups you inherit. So in Schelties and all animals, there's variants of those genes. If you're not varied in those genes that make up your white blood cell groups, you're more at risk for autoimmune disorders because your immune system is unvaried. So if there's a problem or there's maybe a viral attack, it's going to be subject to that because there's no other, it's just one set of white blood cells. There's nobody, like if the virus kills set A, people have a set B to go by or maybe somewhat protective. With dogs, if they're unvaried there and they're fixed or they inherit all these genes that are predictive of thyroid disease and the environment they grow up in is not conducive to being a healthy thyroid, then you start getting these kind of diseases that are, you know, hit or miss, kind of out there, but not always there, maybe in certain lines, because mm-hmm. they have the most genes associated with that disease. Mm-hmm. So they have maybe like maybe 20 genes associated with it. They have like 15 and one line has only 7, but we don't know them yet, so we can't test for them. So you have to just be very careful. Once you start seeing things like disease, then you know that you've inherited too much. That line has too many potentially, and you have to go back and breed away from that.
Right.
Because we don't have good testing at this time point.
Right. Okay. That's beautiful. And that actually is really a good understanding, or helps me understand it. And if it helps me understand, hopefully it'll help everybody else understand, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the hardest part is like taking the terminology and making it accessible, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the difficult part because
right.
I can tell you all you want about the things that I know, but it's not accessible anymore.
Right.
So it seems like something untangible you can't use in a breeding program. And
right.
I like doing seminars that are for use in a breeding program, that there are tools that you develop to move on
right.
instead of kind of guessing.
Right. Well, and I think that, you know, what you're talking about helps me understand. And by happenstance and luck, maybe I fell into that basic concept, which is I had a problem. I bred away from it, right? Like I did a whole bunch of outcrossing
yeah.
and I've, if you will, washed that gene pool. And so I guess then when we look at that sort of thing and you know that you have this core that you want to get back to, right? And so you have to go out here and bring in some outside influence to, if you will, expand that gene pool, get more of the good white blood cells.
Get more variation.
More variation,
you
right?
want good variation.
Yeah, okay.
You don't want to be a similar, you know, I had a question once posed to me that why wouldn't I just take two dogs and backbreed them over and over again and uniform an organism basically that mm-hmm. was a clone or a clonal population, which we do in mice or we've done in mice previously.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, as you inbreed so much or you inbreed like higher and higher, fertility starts to wane.
Yep.
So very rare breeds typically have poor fertility because they're so uniform. So it's very difficult then to rehabilitate that because you're only getting maybe one puppy per litter. And then you're trying to induce variation with only a small gene pool. It can be very difficult.
Right. Excellent. Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. Heads up, crew. Join our patrons today. Get immediate access to the support of a closed Facebook chat group, special patrons-only episodes, free mentoring sessions, and more. Just like the NPR of dogdom, Pure Dog Talk brings you the news, the knowledge, and the insight to succeed with your purebred dog. In exchange, our Pure Dog patrons share the love with monthly or annual gifts, and that helps defray the cost of overhead and sort of keeping the MP3s rolling, you know? Hit me up, Laura at puredogtalk.com, and I'll hook you up with the details. Okay, so again, we talk about, and this is great because you're a breeder and a geneticist, so it like totally helps people get it. You have an outcross, you have a line breeding, you have an inbreeding. And you're breeding on phenotype, right? So this dog is an outcross, but it kind of looks like my dog's.
Correct.
Does that feel like something that works? Have you got any data on that?
So I don't have any data on what truly works and what doesn't work.
That's what I'm looking for, numbers, man.
I know. What works is that, is breeding like phenotype. But I think that what doesn't work are classical methods of thinking where you can only breed within your lines or within the dogs that you know, because that's not totally true.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at dog breeds as, you know, a population, and then we look at different pockets of where dogs are. And so with you know, shipments of semen now and frozen semen and advanced reproduction. There's no limits on what used to be more isolated populations of dogs that would look like a type within each section of a geographical area, like northeast, southeast.
Right.
It's more uniform now, but there are still those pockets. So you want to know how many pockets you have that are unrelated to the dogs that you have, that in case you start seeing that you need variation, you can extend to one of those areas where you're getting an outcross.
Yeah.
But you don't want to use them all up, right? Because then you're done. Once you use them all up and you've already gained all that variation, then you start to decline in what you would gain or where you can go if something goes awry.
Mm-hmm.
So outcross to a point, line breed to a point, but you should be watching what's happening. You should be watching what you're getting. If your litter sizes are going down, if you don't choose for fertility, you're choosing against it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the biggest thing I can say, that I see a common methodology where they're just choosing dogs based on type and health testing, but they're not looking at fertility, which is an inherited trait. So you want to choose the most fertile. So again, like, that's another layer to add to this.
Right.
But I didn't get into this because it's easy.
Nobody did, honey.
I enjoy a challenge. So I would tell the people who are getting into it because they think it's easy. It's not. You have to think about all this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it upsets me when people choose a specific maybe color group of a dog that maybe has different color groups because it's easier.
Right.
But you're eliminating 50% of the population or maybe 2/3 because
mm-hmm.
you've only chosen a single color group to work within. So that can be limiting.
So Shelties, that's an easy choice, right? Like, I'll only breed sable, but what about?
Exactly.
Right.
But it doesn't work for you. That works against you in the long
mm-hmm.
run because then you're only breeding with 1/4 of what is potentially there.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to like take that outcrossing and breed somewhat to things that you know or look like your dogs, because then even if it's away from your stuff, because then they may have genes that can accentuate that. You shouldn't lose with what you have, but you want to be careful again how many times you just go away, because then you can be inducing disease too.
Mm-hmm.
So my biggest advice is, as you know, make sure your record keeping is really good so you can go and remember what happened, because sometimes you don't remember 2 months ago and you don't remember what line that truly was from,
mm-hmm.
and you may have forgotten, and then you're just going to be thinking about how to get away from this, and you're going to want that data that you've collected.
Right, right.
So
I think good record keeping and good awareness of your pedigrees, right? Like looking,
exactly.
Okay, oh, look, I did double up on that dog, and now all of a sudden I have whatever, right?
And you can't just look 4 generations back and say, I'm clear. I can make a lot of dogs have a coefficient of inbreeding, you know, of 0. From that, but we all know that every breed was founded from small stock. So there is an inherent homozygosity, which is uniformity of individual, because they've originated from very few dogs.
Right, right. Okay, so this is fabulous, and I love this. So now talk to us a little bit about the research you're doing, because I think it bears directly on what we're talking about.
Yeah. So the research that I do or I am part of is a larger area within the veterinary hospital where we look at genetic disorders of dog and man, because, again, no one's going to pay the big bucks for a veterinary-funded research project. It's just not in the stars for us. So what we do is we partner with the human side because a lot of dog disorders mimic human disorders, and they're very much closer to us than a mouse is, because a mouse's immune system is not similar to ours. So if these expression of disease is somewhat similar, treatments that we have that work in the mice, or
mm-hmm.
then, you know, we get some dogs and then we see how it goes. And if it goes well, those treatments will go on to humans, and they can treat both dogs and humans. So we need them just as much as they need us, because they show us these things or these diseases. And when we find them within breeds, that's how we start developing testing for them. We start to categorize. You know, what I do is, if you go to the NC State website for the veterinary school and you look at their genetics section, you can actually put in counseling questions to us. 2 residents will go over that question, and then they come to myself and Dr. Buras, who are geneticists, and we will look at that question with our residents and discuss the, you know, counseling of that, how we answer it.
Wow. So give me a for instance. What's the type of thing you would get a question about? Just curiosity.
We get all sorts. We get coat color questions. We get questions on diseases. We get questions on inbreeding.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get questions on health testing. So if my dog was tested and he came back this, you know, capital A, little B, little B.
Right.
And then,
right.
you know, his offspring came back something that did wasn't compatible.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, the last is, what should we do? And then we talk about how we talk to the lab and
mm-hmm.
how to remedy that. But that's how I find disease, or that's a part of it. Is, veterinarians are really poor at finding genetic disease in dogs because A, they're rare, and B, I don't see a Pomeranian or a Yorkie, like the same thing daily, you know, 10 of them.
Right.
Say, oh, we have a problem. I saw this disease, you know, 4 or 5 times in the past 6 months. It's because breed clubs see the same breed over and over again that they advocate for disease testing or they advocate for disease research. So once we accept those diseases as potentially translatable to humans, then we get even more power and funding to start trying to classify these diseases and then make treatment modalities for them, because the disorders we study that are genetic and PEN are called orphan disorders. So less than 1,000 people in the country have them. And without the testing or research that we do, we would unfortunately never get treatments for their disease.
Oh, wow. And yet we're able to get that information because you're working with the canine population.
Yeah, with dogs.
That's awesome. That is just awesome. So can you talk about any of the specific ones that you're working on, or are they like state secrets?
They're not secret, but we don't have any like novel or new diseases
that we
look at. So it's just kind of a little stagnant right now.
Mm-hmm.
But we have storage disorders, and so we similarly look at these disorders.
Right.
But nothing really pressing right now.
Okay. Awesome. And so as we move forward with our preservation breeding programs, and we're mm-hmm. looking at the dogs we have in front of us, and we have a dog that's clear and a dog that's, say, affected with, pick a thing, that's polygenic and we don't know what to do.
So, yeah, probably like hip dysplasia.
Hip dysplasia, thyroid, whatever. And the dog that's clear and the dog that's affected have essentially the same pedigree. Do we breed the dog that's affected?
So my stance on affected status is that if the disease is not causing significant harm to the animal and it does not render them infertile, then I don't have a problem with breeding the affected to a clear dog, as long as you're testing for it.
And then do you continue to breed affected even if you're trying to get rid of the disease? That's my question. At what point do we say...
So if you're trying to get rid of disease...
Right.
There's no fault in that because, yeah, you have dog A that's affected, so it has 2 bad genes.
Correct.
Then you breed it to a clear because you can't breed that to a carrier, because then if you bred it to a carrier, you'd have 50% of the dogs would be affected.
Right.
So you want to breed to a clear because that will produce 100% carrier state. So everybody will have the gene. But you know that. So you're breeding with knowledge. So you're starting off on the right foot. Those dogs that are carriers, I would breed then to clears again.
Right.
And then you would make a smaller population of carriers.
Right.
And as you just keep going, it's like percentages, or it's taking portions of it. You know, you're not going to eliminate the disease in generations unless you find it rapidly. What you're going to do is you're going to take that disease-causing allele or bad gene, and you're going to start to diminish the frequency that you find it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we do with health testing. When we assess how well we're testing or if we're making a mark in this, we look at how many dogs were tested in this year or this time period and this time period, and we see what was the frequency that we saw of the bad gene.
Right.
As long as it's going down, you're making headway.
Right.
Because you want to keep it. You don't want to eliminate individuals from the breeding population. You want to keep as much as you can. The more you eliminate, the more genes you lose, the more that dog could have saved potentially multiple generations because it has X gene. I mean, it has a C gene, which would have then defended against this disease. So you want to just keep in mind that.
I think this is where a lot of people get hung up, right? So the idea is we're going to breed affected, but after we do that, we're only going to breed the carriers. So
correct.
At what point do you quit saying we should breed the affected one? That's the one where I think people get hung up.
So the affected ones, I would stop breeding them once you started making headway. So
okay. That's
a difficult question a little bit because...
Right. That's why I'm asking you. You're the expert.
Well, it's so varied because if we have a disease that's really rare within a breed, then I would never breed affected because you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a disease that's maybe moderately prevalent or incidence, you know, how much you see it,
mm-hmm.
a moderate to high,
mm-hmm.
then you're going to want to use affected because you're going to be losing more.
Okay.
All genetics is
that
boils down
sense.
To basically risk assessment. So
right. What's
the least risk I can take and get the most benefit from these crossings, these pairings, these how to mitigate damage. It's damage
control. Right.
So when you have a highly prevalent disease and you're seeing it all the time, you cannot eliminate carriers. I mean, and you cannot eliminate affected maybe, because then that's 3/4 of the entire population.
Mm-hmm.
So in genetics, we have this thing called Hardy-Weinberg equilibria, where they described what genes do, where they go.
Mm-hmm.
If a population of animals is just allowed to do whatever they want, how do the genes distribute themselves? And they mostly fall on a bell curve where most animals would be carriers, or they'd have a variation at that gene point.
Mm-hmm.
Or that locus, which is where a gene lies on a
right.
chromosome. Given that most in a situation would fall within the carrier state, you cannot eliminate them, because that's 50% of your population you would be eliminating, and then all those genes with it.
Mm-hmm.
So if the disease was rare or uncommon, maybe only in lines, then if it was only in lines, you would have to counsel just those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was really bad within those lines, you would have to use affected.
Mm-hmm.
But if it wasn't, maybe you could stay to carriers, and you could then breed away from it. So as long as you're breeding with knowledge and moving with testing, you'll be able to breed away from the disease state and then lower the frequency that you see the bad disease-causative allele to eventually eliminate it. And that's multiple years in a very, very short time that I said that. But
right.
That's basically what health testing does. It's not just, you know, this dog is carrier, do not breed him. It is, this dog is a carrier, we can breed him to a clear. We would have to test the offspring, and we're continuing every generation to move towards no disease, or making this disease allele that we see become infrequent to the point where it does not cause disease.
Right. Excellent. Okay. That was beautiful. Thank you so much. I have taken a full solid half an hour of your valuable time, and
I appreciate it.
More than you know, I'm keeping your number because there's going to be something else I want to ask you. I guarantee it.
That's fine. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. All right, guys, here's Petmates tip of the week. We travel with our dogs. We travel with our dogs constantly. That's what we do. When I was handling, I was putting on 40 and 50,000 miles a year in a vehicle, driving. That's what we do. We drive to dog shows. We drive to tests. We drive to trials. We drive to the vet. We drive everywhere. Keep your dog safe. As cute as it is for him to ride with his head on your shoulder, he isn't safe. If you have a wreck, he can get loose, he can run away, he can get hurt. If you take your eyes off the road, he can cause the wreck. Keep your dog and yourself safe by putting them in a dog crate when you travel. That is the best advice I can offer. And Petmate has plastic kennels that are safe and secure. Check out special savings just for you guys at www.puredogtalk.com/partners. And then use promo code PUREDOG. As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.